Hello and welcome to History Lessons at Engelsberg Ideas, an in-depth discussion with a leading historian on their latest work. It's hosted by Matthias Hesseris.
Deodar's naming compound interest as the eighth wonder of the world is usually attributed to Albert Einstein. Now, there does not seem to be any proof that Einstein in fact said this at all, but the fact remains. The power interest rates have held over our economies past and present is nothing short of miraculous. The basic premise seems obvious. One must pay to borrow money. And yet this idea has gone from being condemned as utterly immoral to becoming the cornerstone of the financial world. However, interest rates have never quite discarded that unsavory tinge. For the past half century, centralized banks have set them to historic lows and in times of economic disaster, even dipping them below zero to create negative interest rates. In his latest book, The Price of Time, financial journalist Edward Chancellor argues that this has not been without consequence, with the poor coming out worst and the rich reaping the benefits. The book explores the fascinating and often riotous history of interest rates, starting in around 2500 BC and ending with the bulging asset bubble of today. Edward, thank you for joining. You've been praised for your sense of timing, catching a topic just before it floods our headlines. What were the indicators that it was time to start looking into interest rates when you decided to start writing this book?
Books take a long time to write. Well, at least this did. So I really had the idea of writing this book in 2015. And I thought that I would have it out for the 10th anniversary of the Lehman bankruptcy in November 2018. So I was actually, my timing was actually 3.5 years late. So had I come out when I planned to finish the book, I don't think anyone would have paid any attention at all. They'd have said, who's this madman crowing on about the dangers of very low interest rates? Books take a long time to write, and there's a matter of luck between the actual publication date and the contemporaneous events that one's describing. Having said that, think back 7 years ago, 2015, my reasoning to start on this project, this history of interest, an examination of where interest came from, what interest did, and how important interest was informed by the fact that 7 years ago and only a year ago, we were living with the lowest interest rates in 5 millennia of history.
Yes.
And at the time, I thought a lot of the things that appeared to be going wrong with the world, the low productivity, the rise in asset price bubbles, and related to that, the increase in inequality, the phenomenon of so-called zombie companies. I was working a bit earlier in the decade for a large investment company, and we saw a lot of risk-taking, yield chasing, where investors seemed to be taking more risk than was prudent. In fact, we actually saw a recurrence of many of the sort of imprudent and dangerous financial practices that occurred immediately prior to the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. So it struck me even 7 years ago that we were moving inexorably towards another financial crisis, and that this time the common denominator, the common theme would be these incredibly low interest rates that we've been living through. So, that period took a long time to play out. But I think my early analysis was later justified by my research. As one's research tends to sort of follow one's priors. But then I think, and we can argue about it, but I think more or less the events of this year, the financial and economic turbulence we're seeing this year, tends to support I would say, of course, the thesis of the book.
Well, you make a very convincing argument that interest rates are really sort of the heart of functioning capitalism in a sense. Could you explain what we know of the ancient origins of interest rates?
Well, we have records of interest going back to ancient Mesopotamia, the 3rd millennia BC. So we have a record of interest rates over 5 millennia or so. If we look at the terms for interest in the ancient languages, whether they're Assyrian or Greek or Egyptian, and later Latin, they all link to productivity of livestock, to the references to sort of calves and to lambs and to kid goats. So what one can surmise in the prehistoric period is that lending took place of agricultural of livestock and grain to was linked to productivity, to output. Then if you go, once we have a sort of a historical record in ancient Mesopotamia, we see that loans are used for much the same purpose as we see them in the modern world. There's an ancient credit market, and loans were used for funding voyages of commercial trips abroad. And what's interesting there is we see that there is a premium charged, an interest premium charged on those risky foreign ventures, because interest contains within it an insurance premium, what I later describe as the price of anxiety. It's not my term, but an 18th century Italian economist, where the notion that if you're going to take a risk with a loan, you need some extra reward. We also see interest in the ancient Babylonian cities being used to to purchase houses in the real estate market, and we see a connection between interest and rent, which as I mentioned, the German word for interest, Zins,
yep,
is also the word for rent, and the French word for the rent on bonds is rente, which clearly comes from rents, and the term for a bondholder is sometimes a rentier, a person who lives off the rents.
So, and you have the same thing. And you have the same thing in Swedish with ränta. So rent.
Yes, and actually, do you know? So I think in a footnote I mentioned that the Scottish notation in the 18th century for interest is actually at rents.
Yeah.
So quick recap. So you have lending linked to productivity of loan for agricultural purposes. You have lending linked to risk taking and compensation for risk. You have interest charged on property linked to rent and for the valuation of properties. So that you see a sort of common theme there that is still evident today.
What I find fascinating, because I'm not an economist, I'm a humble historian, and for me, when you, the way you explain it, and also explain it in historical terms, it also it sort of carves out a logic. Sometimes we just take it for granted today that you either have, well, we have a generation now that takes very low interest for granted, but of course risk is at the heart of lending money for the lender. And it's also, would you say that it is important that you think about the risk, that there is a risk involved?
Well, I mean, I would say more grandly that you know, that interest is charged on all activities, economic activities that take place across time. And risk is one of the functions that you assume when you're engaged in investing or borrowing or lending. So yes, I think that the risk is an essential feature. You need to put a price on risk. If risk is is too low, if the price of risk is too low, then you will find people take bets that are loss-making. I mean, in fact, actually, if you look back to the global financial crisis, the financial engineers developed this something called a credit default swap, which was actually just the risk element on a loan. And the part of the speed and the depth of the global financial crisis was caused by the losses on these credit default swaps. And for instance, it was the losses on these financial derivatives linked to, if you will, to the embedded risk interest on a loan that brought down AIG Group, the world's largest insurance company. And so you could say it was the mispricing of risk on loans that contributed to the global financial crisis, played a very large role in it.
You're right that the greatest minds have been sort of against money lending. You have Aristotle, St. Augustine, even Shakespeare. Where does this moral case against charging interest come from?
Well, I think it's partly well justified and partly a misunderstanding. The justification against what's called usury, an excessive interest charge, is based on the fact that, or on an assumption that the rich and the powerful are using their control of resources of money to exploit the poor and the needy, and that I think is true throughout traditional, if you will, sort of peasant-based agricultural economies, and you one reads about it today of debt bondage in places like India, so there is definitely a capacity or a part of the history of interest has been exploitative. I think that there's another element that one sees again in the ancient world of debt building up with compound interest, and how if you're living in an economy that is not growing, a sort of static agricultural economy, then if the interest rate charge is high, then the loan will become higher and higher and more untenable. And in the ancient societies in Babylon and Israel and Egypt, you had these debt jubilees where debt, which had compounded over time, was then forgiven. For instance, in ancient Israel, I think the debt jubilee was once every 50 years. In Babylonia, the debt jubilee, the forgiveness of debts, tended to occur when a new ruler came to power. So that's, if you will, the sort of justified argument against interest. The intellectual error, and I think you find this in Aristotle, who makes this famous denunciation of charging interest, where he says that that money was created not, that it was artificial for money to grow with the loan, that money was created for exchange, and that it was wrong to demand back more than had been given. So that looks like a straightforward argument, and this argument was taken up by the early church fathers and was expressed throughout the Middle Ages by the Catholic Church, Thomas Aquinas, and the other sort of church scholars of the Middle Ages. But the error of this analysis, which I point out, is that it ignores the fact that the loan takes place over a period of time. That the loan may be productive. For instance, if you're buying a house and you might rent it out, or if you're buying buying some cattle, you might breed from those cattle. The loans has a value over the period of time. So Aristotle ignores the the time that follows the loan. If a loan was made and instantaneously had to be paid back, it would clearly be unfair, unjust, to demand more than had actually been provided. But if the loan is made, if you hand someone the use of your property, your capital, your money, for a period of time, whether 6 months, a year, or 10 years, and they are able to use your property over that period, it seems reasonable that the lender, who's provided the capital, his possessions, should share in the gains. And that was sort of gradually realised in the, as I note in the book, in the sort of later Middle Ages. Even the church, even those who, even the church scholars began to realise that it was fair enough for the lender to partake in some of the, if you will, the profits of the lending. And bear in mind that this was taking that change of mind was taking place in Italy in the 14th and 15th century, when Italy was establishing banks and merchants were lending with bills of exchange and trading across Europe. So sort of proto capitalism, early financial capitalism, it is also associated with a gradual, grudging acceptance of the legitimacy of interest.
When you look at actual interest rates over time, do they fluctuate a lot, or are they pretty stable? What would you say?
Well, different people have views about the direction of interest. I think there are sort of several interesting things to say about the long-term level of interest. First of all, interest in different societies or civilizations, and even under different sort of currency regimes, appear to have different norms. So, and as I point out, In the ancient world, it seems to be related to the number systems that were prevalent at the time. So the Babylonians used what's called a sexagismal systems, which were based on where numbers are divided by 60. And so you have interest charged at 20% and 30%, and then the Greeks used the decimal system, and interest tended to be charged at 10%, and the Romans used a duodecimal system, which was interest charged at 12%. So these are sort of weird norms related, and Marx says that in his commentary that interest is to some extent a matter of tradition. I think he's right in that way. And then if we go to the modern period, we've gone through different sort of currency systems in the last 200 years. From a gold standard to a sort of quasi gold standard to a sort of what we call a fiat money standard, and interest rates have been different, have had different average levels through all those different systems, monetary systems. Then I think that as lending improves, as the sort of technology of lending improves, you establish banks and so on and so forth, then it's easier to circulate savings, and that efficiency in itself brings interest down. So those are sort of different functions. Different periods, different eras have different normal rates of interest. Can one see a shift in interest rates over the last 500 years? I think if you're looking in nominal terms, in other words, just looking at the sort of the charge, the actual charge of interest, ignoring whether inflation or deflation, then there doesn't seem to be much movement in or long-term trend in interest rates. But what has happened is that over the last century, as we move to this paper money system, mm-hmm. we have had much higher rates of interest than ever before in history. So, you know, in Weimar Germany in 1923, I think interest rates went up to, let's say, sort of 12,000 to 15,000%, and that was, you know, way below the level of inflation. And you saw similar, you know, four-digit levels of inflation in Chile and Argentina in the 1970s. So very, very high rates of interest under paper currencies have appeared over the last 100 odd years. And then, you know, much of the focus of this current book is on the extraordinary low rates of interest.
Exactly. And you tell the story of two 19th century French politicians debating interest rates. And one, an anarchist, argues that the Bank of France ought to be nationalized and raised interest rates set to almost zero. His ideas were rejected as ludicrous at the time. But now we've been there. And so can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so there was this debate in I think 1849 between Proudhon, the French anarchist, best known for his comment that property was theft, and Frédéric Bastiat, who was a journalist, a politician, and if you will, sort of laissez-faire economist, And Bastiat is best known for his economic parables in which he describes sort of the unintended consequences of economic actions. So Proudhon is demanding in the interests of the workers, or what he claims to be the interests of the workers, is demanding that a central bank be established, a paper money issued, and that the loans should be made at close to zero. I think he allows 0.5% for cost of administration. And as Bastiat then argues against Proudhon, he says this would be a disaster. He said, as I'd been mentioning earlier, he said it was quite reasonable that lenders should partake in some of the profits of their of the loan, but he also said that the poor wouldn't benefit. In fact, I've got my book open or on the page. He says, in your system, Bastiat wrote to Proudhon, the rich will indeed borrow gratis, while the poor will not be able to borrow at any price. When a rich man presents himself at the bank, he will be told, you are solvent, here's the capital, we lend it to you for nothing. But let a worker dare to show his face, he will be asked, where are your guarantees, your lands, your houses, your goods? I have only my arms and my probity, the worker replies. That does not reassure us. We must act with prudence and severity. We cannot lend you gratis.
Is that what happened?
So what happened after the financial crisis is that loans were available at next to nothing if you were well positioned on Wall Street or in the City of London. Mm. And, you know, I spoke to, you know, I remember a few years after the financial crisis, a hedge fund manager friend of mine saying how he and his friends, you know, he and his colleagues had just acquired a telecoms business, and the yield on this business was, I don't know, 10 or 15%, but they'd been able to borrow at 2%. And so it was a hugely and immediately profitable deal. But at the same time, as the banks were lending to very rich people worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, at almost no cost to make investments that were almost guaranteed to be cast iron investments, who were guaranteed to make them a great deal more money. At the same time, poor people, as Bastiat had surmised, when they went along to the bank, they were told, oh no, you know, we're tightening our subprime lending. And actually the interest charges for the less credit worthy borrowers actually climbed after the financial crisis, as the banks sought to be more prudent. So in that sense, the Bastiat, I think, was completely vindicated, and the central banks, unwittingly, as I say, were sort of following the dictates of an anarchist. I mean, of course, they wouldn't recognise this, or they'd consider it. In fact, actually, one reviewer of my book said, this claim is so absurd, readers may not wish to go any further with this book, which was, I mean, an absurd riposte to me, because I wasn't saying that the central bankers had actually turned into anarchists.
Right.
I was saying that they were unwittingly following policies that came very close to the advice that Proudhon had dished out 170 years earlier.
But what about a subprime lending in the first place?
The question with subprime lending was, I think that, you know, that every person should receive a loan, and the loan should be priced relative to the risk that they pose of not paying it back. So, you know, often people inveigh against payday lenders. So you remember I mentioned the Archbishop of Canterbury launching a few years back what was known as the War on Wonga, which was a British payday lender that was said to charge very high rates of interest. And in fact, actually, it turns out that Wonga, even without the Archbishop of Canterbury's help, went bust because it wasn't charging enough on its loans to compensate for the defaults. Mm. But to go back to the subprime, the idea about subprime was in effect not a bad idea, was that you put together all these slightly riskier mortgages together and that would sort of lower their collective risk, which would allow for a lower interest charge. Sort of a bit like insurance, if you will. Trouble was that the subprime lending went into these very complex securities that were then chopped up, and then they were given the appearance of being investment grade, you know, the equivalent of US government debt, and that encouraged people to more and more leverage, and then to make more and more of these loans. So there was too much lending going on in the subprime category, you know, before the global financial crisis, and there were then, you know, these so-called liar loans. So I was living in the States at the time. You know, there were stories of people in prison filling in subprime mortgage applications, and then hoping to sort of flip flip the properties they bought within 6 months for a profit. So it was just the whole thing in effect turned into a Ponzi scheme.
So it started out as a clever idea that went quite badly. But I also wonder, couldn't you argue that loosening interest rates after the financial crash was a necessary evil? What were the options?
Well, it's complicated. In general, into financial crises, interest rates have always tended to rise because there's a so-called dash for cash. You know, everyone who's got debt and who's taken on too much debt or who's invested in sort of dodgy credit securities, they drop the credit securities, they want cash, and then so cash tends to rise to a premium. So you have, you know, you tend to see spikes in interest, and that often involves the sort of flushing out of the system of the bad loans that have been previously made. There is a case, it goes back actually to Walter Badgett, who I've already mentioned, where he elaborated the principle that during a financial crisis, the central bank should lend during the crisis. But Badgett said that the lending should be at high interest rates against high quality collateral for a limited period of time. Whereas we have... And the so-called Badgett rule is much cited by modern central bankers and policymakers, but it's been corrupted over time so that the central bank lender of last resort, as it's called, tends to be lending at low interest rates against increasingly low quality collateral for, you know, very long or unlimited periods of time. So think about it. In 2008, the Fed came to the rescue of the US and global financial system by expanding its balance sheet to buy treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. And it cut interest rates down to close to zero. And then over the next following years, there was all this discussion about reversing these policies, but they never were reversed. The so-called quantitative easing was never reversed. There were periods in which quantitative easing was stopped, but the central banks never slimmed down their balance sheet. They were never able to sell back to the market the securities that they'd taken out of the market. They sort of pushed things too far, but the point was that they never escaped from the sort of what you might call the interest rate trap that they'd set themselves, that they'd set after the financial crisis.
We seem to be in a bit of a trap now. First of all, is quantitative easing just money printing, or how would you describe it?
It slightly depends on what happens to the money, to make things complicated. When quantitative easing was initially practiced, it was basically to acquire distressed debt at the time of financial crisis, when everyone was scrambling for cash, and the banks were not lending because they were facing large losses from the housing bust in the US and elsewhere. And so the money, you saw this sort of massive expansion of the central bank's balance sheet, having printed, in inverted commas, so much money and acquired all these assets. But at the same time, you saw a massive increase in the deposits of the banks with the central bank. So it was sort of the money went out of one door and immediately back in through another. And the effect was not inflationary in terms of consumer prices, but it was massively inflationary in terms of asset prices. And so what we saw over the last decade was what people called the everything bubble. Whatever asset people had, whether it was a bond or a share or a house or cryptocurrency or a non-fungible token or a work of contemporary art, you name it, everything apart from sort of English brown furniture went up in price. and we had the so-called everything bubble. Which I think is probably is the greatest asset price inflation in history. Then you had the COVID quantitative easing, and there the conditions are slightly different because the banks at this stage weren't faced with losses, and in fact the loans that they were making were being guaranteed by the government. So the banks were not, even in the face of lockdowns and the economic collapse, the banks were not contracting their lending, and at the same time, the money that was being printed was roughly the same amount as the government deficits, which were then being paid out through furlough payments in Britain or stimulus checks in the US, going into people's pockets. So people during this sort of unreal lockdown period were able to go out on, spend money, spend their time, happily or unhappily locked in their houses, speculating on the stock market and leading this sort of extraordinarily unreal existence. I wrote a piece, about this at the time, was seeing it was sort of Alice in Wonderland world of finance that we suddenly sort of found ourselves living through, and at the core of this were these extraordinarily low interest rates that were making making these large government deficits. Like, for instance, the British government deficit in 2020-21 went to 15% of GDP. But the bulk of that money was financed indirectly by the Bank of England that was only charging 1/10 of a percentage point to the government, to the British government, for its loans. So this incredibly easy money, low interest rates, yeah, and easy money, then fed through to massive government deficits, and then helped to set the eventual inflation in place.
What I find fascinating here is, of course, that you discuss Hayek quite a lot, and Hayek, for Hayek, the middle classes are the most important, the most important class in the economy to sort of create stability, and this is really what we're seeing now. So in my generation, I'm in my 40s, you see a lot of people who've been taking on massive mortgages. I hear friends saying that they felt they were promised that interest rate would remain low. And now you can see that only a 1% 1% upping of interest rate or 2% creates massive effects for people, people's economies. And so I wonder, where do we go from here? What's going to happen with the middle classes in this situation?
I think that it's, some people have read my book and said, Edward Chancellor thinks that interest rates must rise. It's not what I say. Actually, what I say very clearly, and probably repeated it several times, is we've got ourselves into a situation where actually raising interest, although these very low interest rates do extraordinary amount of damage, both economic, financial and social, you can't get out of this position overnight, because you would just bring the house of cards down. And say, take for instance, UK housing and mortgages. The average mortgage size relative to income is now much greater than it was in the 1980s when interest rates were much higher. And I read analysis the other day that said that an interest rate in 1980 of 14% is equivalent, takes in terms of the cost of the mortgage relative to, yes, the borrower's income, is equivalent to 3% today.
Yes.
So you can see, and I don't know, I tried to run those numbers and I don't quite get there. And in the early 1980s, we used to have something called mortgage income relief, or MIRAS. And so that blunted the cost of interest somewhat. But now you can quite clearly see that there is huge sensitivity of the housing market and of borrowers. English have the misfortune to borrow on the whole on short term, on sort of floating rate mortgages. They take out, 1-2 year mortgage that then resets. And what last year they were borrowing at 2% on these fixed rate mortgages, and those mortgages were as in the brief-lived Truss government, when the gilts market crashed, the markets then started pricing in much higher rates, and they were those mortgages were about to reset at 6%, so that the effective cost of the mortgage was going to be three times what it had been a year ago. And that was, throw in, cost of living crisis, energy bills and so forth. That was obviously going to put a great deal of, the middle classes, as you say, in trouble. And I suspect, you don't see it written everywhere, that the real reason that Truss and her government were thrown out is that the British public vote with house prices, and the moment those interest rates rose and the housing market looked vulnerable, you see immediately the sort of Tories collapsed in the opinion polls and Labour went soaring. So I think that they and what's interesting then is that the Bank of England stepped in again to buy gilts, long-dated bonds, in order to keep their prices down, in order to help stabilise the mortgage market and the gilts market.
But where do we go from here then? Are we trapped? What's next?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to say what's next. There are sort of, in the near term, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and there are a number of, vulnerabilities in the financial system, some of which I describe in the book. Although, the world's a complex place, and I don't imagine for a second that I've managed to comprehend all the risks that are out there. But I mean, go back to this, the crash in the gilts market. These long-dated government bonds, index-linked bonds that were being acquired by pension funds, some of those fell 85% in price, even though the interest on these bonds only was a little over, at the end of that 85% fall, was only at just over 1%. So you can see how much these are gilt-edged bonds. These are so-called risk-free bonds, which are even insured against inflation. And yet they lost 85% of their value and nearly brought down the UK pensions fund industry. So that's showing you that vulnerability. You've got we've mentioned the vulnerability of housing. You've got as I describe in the book, both the British and American economies, they're highly what we call financialized. We have these bloated financial systems, which I again argue is largely a function of these extraordinary low rates. Because it encourages too much financial activity, too much leverage. We've got, the largest amount of leverage of total debt to income in history. So we have, and at the same time, we have the Federal Reserve trying to combat domestic inflation. And the US is most important because the dollar is the global funding currency. So you have this position that the Fed may at any moment create a financial accident that brings about a rupture or mark, a severe market collapse of the. So I think that I mean it's difficult to say that, but I think that the situation today is as vulnerable as it was in, say, 2007. You have to bear in mind that in 2007 people didn't realize that the global financial crisis. Yes. Was around the corner. They saw problems. There was a problem with the Northern Rock Bank and the problems with these French money market accounts that had these subprime debts, and problems at a few hedge funds. But it didn't. You had to know what was going on to realise how vulnerable the situation was. I think over the longer term, because interest rates cannot be allowed to rise from their current level, we're in for a prolonged period of what's called financial repression, where interest rates are maintained below the rate of inflation, and that serves to pay off the excess debts we built up. But the trouble with financial repression is that it requires the government to continue playing a very large role in the allocation of credit. So the sort of downside of that is that the governments are likely to play an even larger role in taking on how credit is used. For instance, they're probably going to be reluctant, and you're seeing this already, that debt should be used to fund share repurchases or leverage buyouts, and they'll want to direct lending towards government-approved ends. So in that sense, I think we're in for a period of inflation, possibly then a sort of tail risk or very high inflation, in the sense that you've got all this central bank money out there. You could see that as a sort of dry tinder that hasn't yet really ignited, but you could see the situation which the central banks have to, like the Bank of England did the other day, have to go out constantly, printing money to buy securities that are distressed, bailing out whether it's homeowners or banks or pension funds, until suddenly, you know, there is a loss of confidence in these paper currencies. So there is a sort of variety of scenarios out there. The best scenario, to my mind, is a sort of controlled financial repression of the type that we saw in the post-war period.
Yes, well, let's hope for that. In 1974, Hayek was awarded the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel. Is it a sign of the times that this year's prize was given to Ben Bernanke?
I don't know. My book, when it was reviewed, probably saw it was reviewed both in The Economist and The Financial Times, alongside a book by Bernanke, a recent book by Bernanke. And both the FT and The Economist said, you know, Chancellor is a sort of dangerous polemicist, whereas, you know, you want to side with Bernanke. I argue in the book that Bernanke didn't really pay attention to the side effects of the monetary policy that he, of the radical, unconventional monetary policy that he was introducing. I think, you know, the Nobel Prize in economics, as you say, the Memorial Prize,
yes,
the Swedish Riksbank's Memorial Prize in economics is often given to the wrong person at the wrong time. It was given, if you remember, to American economists Merton and Scholes for their work on stock options pricing, and they, at the time when those economists were involved with this hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management, whose collapse nearly brought down the global financial system. I think with Bernanke, the fact that they gave Bernanke a Nobel Prize, I think is a way of a sort of, if you will, the economics establishment being very unrepentant, and they're saying, you know, we know we've been criticised, but you know, we still think, you know, what we've done is the right thing. And here we are, we're awarding a prize to the economist to the central banker economist who's most associated with the policies of monetary policies of the last decade, of the post-crisis policies. But they're doing it at a time when, as I say, the gilts market is crashing, and this looks like a canary in the coal mine for really serious problems to come. So I think that I think it's mistimed award. But as you say, it's a sign of the times that policymakers often have this incredibly narrow focus on what they're wishing to achieve, and that creates this cognitive dissonance where they're incapable, apparently, of seeing the unintended consequences of their actions. So that it's left to sort of laymen like myself, outside of the policy-making world, to put the dots together.
Edward Chancellor, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to our latest episode of History Lessons, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. You can find more episodes of History Lessons and the rest of our podcasts and articles at engelsbergideas.com. History Lessons is hosted by Matthias Caceres and is produced and edited by Eve Webster.